Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today on the program, and joining us on the line, Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. They are here to answer your questions about space, comets, you know, anything out there in the final frontier. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Again, that number is 800-348-2551. Astronomers Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. And your phone calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers on the line. Not one, but two. And they are here to answer your questions about space and everything in it. We have Bob Berman, the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. We have Valerie Rapson, chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory, who earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email the program also, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you all here. You know, Valerie, you sent an email with some suggested topics yesterday. All right, well, I'm gonna launch into this. Tell me about Lunar Build a Toilet Challenge.
Yes. I saw this news note, too, and it just made me laugh. So they're starting this competition for a newly designed space toilet. And to our listeners, if you've never Googled how do you poop in space, you definitely need to do it after the show just to figure it all out. But, you know, you might imagine that it's kind of difficult to use a toilet in space and on the space station, and we're going to need a new design when we go back to the moon. So NASA's trying to pique engineers' interest and see if we can come up with a better functioning design for males and females.
I see. And Bob, I know that we have talked about this in the past, but I can't remember the actual answer. How did they relieve themselves on the earlier lunar missions?
Well, on the lunar missions, one of the interesting things, I forget which Apollo program it was, but the commander said to the other guys, you know, I wrote a book about this, about the entire Apollo program called Shooting for the Moon, to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the first Apollo lander. And the commander of that mission, and I could run to my library and look it up, but I'm not going to do that, actually ordered the others during the 3 days en route to the moon, go down there to the lower level and poop right now. The guy said, are you kidding me? I can't. I'm not going to. What, you're in charge of our bodies now? And he said, absolutely. I don't want anyone wasting any time when we get to the moon doing that. You're going to do it now. I don't want anyone doing that when we're actually on the moon. Go down and do it, and that's an order.
All right. Well, so that explains the when, but how about the how?
Right. Well, I know how they work in space, in the zero gravity that people experience in space, and the 1/6 gravity on the moon, that would be a lot closer to earthly things, except everything would fall 6 times more slowly. Do we have to get into the details?
No, we don't. As a matter of fact, let's move on to the next thing. The number here is, I'm really sorry this came up, 800-348-2551 is the number. Valerie, you also sent a very interesting piece on a topic we have discussed the last few shows, and that is Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse, as Bob will say, that was dimming and now is brightening again, and there is now perhaps a theory as to why all that was going on.
Yeah, so I know that people have watched Betelgeuse dim and brighten over the last couple of months, and originally scientists thought that it was dust, that the star had either expelled some material or there was dust around it, and it basically moved in front and blocked the light. But some of the most recent research that came out showed that they looked at the star in all wavelengths, specifically submillimeter radio wavelengths, and the star dimmed at those wavelengths as well. Which is weird if it's just dust, because the submillimeter light can actually get through the dust.
Right.
So you shouldn't expect to see the dimming in that wavelength if that's what's causing it. So now they think it might actually be star spots, where like 70% of the star was covered in these dark, cooler spots, making it look dimmer. It's really interesting.
And so this is a sunspot, but not on our sun, right?
Yeah, basically a sunspot, just a million times bigger, literally.
Yeah, and it should be added that Betelgeuse was the only star that we had detected originally star spots on, and this is going back probably 20 years or so, and that was because it has the largest apparent size of any star. I mean, it's quite far away. It's about 600 light years away, so that would make it harder to see it as anything but a pinpoint. You know, stars are pinpoints through the best telescopes, but using a process called interferometry, images were actually built up of Betelgeuse alone, and we were able to see that, and sure enough, there's a giant, giant star spot that dwarfed anything that anyone had ever imagined. So when Valerie is talking about star spots dimming the light, absolutely on Betelgeuse, it's very possible. Mm.
Now, Bob, in your book, The Sun's Heartbeat, you talk about sunspots and what happens during sunspots, and I happen to know that it affects our ionosphere to some extent, because when it darkens and cools, right, there's a lot more energy of some kind coming out. Couldn't they also measure that at Betelgeuse?
Yes, absolutely. And Valerie's absolutely right. In other words, it's an intrinsic, inherent dimming that Betelgeuse is going through, which is what we actually thought from beginning. We thought that very old supergiant stars have an inherent change in brightness, partially because they expand and contract like giant red balloons, and they get bigger and smaller, and something that's bigger is going to naturally have more surface to give off more light. So there's several reasons other than that slightly unconvincing idea that it was expelling dust, that the dust in turn was blocking it. So now we have more explanation.
That wasn't exactly my question. That's because I didn't pose it in a very good way. When our sun has a lot of sunspots, we have more HF, high frequency radio activity here, because there's ionization, and I assume that means there's more stuff coming out of the sun or more energy of some kind. So if Betelgeuse has this enormous sunspot or star spot, then isn't there some way to measure the magnetism or whatever comes out of that thing that charges up our ionosphere? Isn't there a way to measure that there?
Yes. There are instruments that have measured that keep track of stars in many wavelengths. Some of them have to be above our atmosphere, but that's quite true. And when you talk about the sun, even though the sun during its 11-year cycle, or 22 years if you include the magnetic polarity of the spots in the cycle, during that time, it doesn't dim by much when the sun has a lot of spots. You're talking about a change in inherent brightness that only amounts to a change from about 1,364 watts per square meter. Now, just picture a sheet spread on the ground, 1 square meter, a yard on a side, that much Earth surface. Well, when the sun is high overhead, normally it lights that up with the lighting of about 1,300 watts. Picture about 1,300 watt light bulbs lighting up each sheet spread on the ground worth of sunlight. Well, the change in visible light is only from about 1,362 to 1,364. So a couple of watts change out of over 1,000. Very little invisible light. But as you just said, Ray, in ultraviolet, especially certain parts of the ultraviolet, the change can be several percent of the ultraviolet flux. And this indeed now, through a series of intermediate steps, can affect our atmosphere. That, in fact, can affect cloud formation. And it turns out there's a whole lot of stuff going on, more than we originally suspected.
Well, Valerie, are we seeing an increase in ultraviolet out of Betelgeuse when these star spot hit?
You know, I haven't seen any ultraviolet data yet. It's totally possible, but we're just now starting to see all of these results because it only happened a few months ago, mm-hmm. and it takes time to collect the data, and then you got to look at it and analyze it, and, you know, the whole scientific process. So it'll be really interesting to see when that comes out, if it's not already, you know, if it correlates with what Bob has been talking about.
All right, let's take a quick break here. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman are here to take your calls, and we'll get to them in a moment. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 if you want to call in. 1-800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman here to answer your astronomy questions. One email here, and then we'll hit the phones. This one's from Dave in Amsterdam. Dave says, you relate three mileposts surrounding winter solstice. Earliest sunset, shortest day, and latest sunrise. When are the equivalent summer events? All right. I guess the guests are asleep. We'll just go to anybody want to, you know?
Well, yes. The silence comes because, you know, I usually have these things in my head. I don't look up stuff, but I think Valerie with her quick fingers may be able to find it. Yeah. I always know the winter dates because we're so desperate then for light that the time of the latest sunrise and the earliest sunset, that's important. Like, plus it's easy because it's Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, when we get our darkest afternoon. That is our earliest sunset.
Yeah.
So easy to remember. So now, when is it, Valerie? Have your fingers?
You're stalling, is what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, I've been stalling here.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I believe it's going to be around, or was around June 13th or 14th, it looks like, and then with the solstice on the 20th, but that's, you know, just super quick glancing a thing here. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, sounds about right.
All right. Well, thank you, David in Amsterdam, for that one. And now let's go to the phones at 800-348-2551. Grace in Sheffield. Grace, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
It was on July 5th of last year. It was a very hot, humid day. I was in Great Barrington, and they had just blacktopped the street that I was walking on. And so blacktop was still, you know, shiny and crystally, no dust on it yet. And it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the sun was behind me. And around my... the shadow of my head, I could see like about 2 feet. Yeah, right, a halo, which is sort of like whatever happens with a rainbow, whatever. I thought it was really cool.
So, it is very cool. It's called the glory that you saw, although it has different names in different countries. There's like the Spreken, Brocken of the Spreken in the Alps. There's a different name for it. What it amounts to is that any moisture particles or dew or anything like that, you see this on lawns at this time of year very readily, will reflect sunlight straight back to you and also refract it, causing all the colors. So that when you look at the shadow of your head on a wet lawn, the shadow of your head, you'll typically see a series of colored rings around the shadow of your head, as if someone up in heaven has decided to make you into a saint. Mm. Looks like halos surrounding the shadow of your head, so I don't get a swelled head because of it. We see that from planes, too. When you look out of an airplane and you see the shadow of the plane on the cloud tops, it'll do the same thing, and it's called the glory.
All right.
But if you ever see that, don't start running down the street and yelling, "I see the glory."
Okay. Why? Now, I like that. It was the Sprecken. What did you say earlier, Bob? Were you making up words?
And because I don't have it exactly correct, I would have to look that up to get that grade. But it's been called, you see, up in the Alps and high mountains, often you could look down and see a cloud layer below you. So you'd see the shadow of your head, same thing, with those rings surrounding the shadow of your head. So it's been noted all around the world. So what our caller is observing, a very, very observant and a very fascinating phenomenon.
Well, Martha, look for it. Thank you very much for the call. Valerie Rapson is here and Bob Berman. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. John in Hyde Park. John, you're on.
Hi, thanks, gang. A two-parter, please. Our star is a second-generation star, correct?
Third generation.
Yep. Third generation, okay. So where does all the hydrogen come from in our sun? Because those previous stars exploded because they used up all their hydrogen, right?
Oh.
Yes, but remember, our sun was born not just from material from the previous generation of stars. Some of that material exploding outward, which you're quite right, was enhanced material thanks to nuclear fusion that changes hydrogen to helium and then changes helium into carbon and oxygen, and that process generates metals. Astronomers call everything that's heavier than hydrogen a metal. We have kind of a stunted vocabulary in that sense. But it's not just that, because that material from previous supernovas traveling through our galaxy, then traveling outward, encountered just a cloud of hydrogen gas that was just minding its own business.
Mm-hmm.
We have these clouds of dusty hydrogen everywhere in our galaxy, and it was the combination of those two that gave it a little extra density, that started it with enough gravity to start self-condensing into the planets and the sun right in the middle. And so it was really a combination of the two. It was mostly hydrogen that was here that got infected with or contaminated with, trying to find a nicer way to put it, with the other stuff. I shouldn't use negative terms.
Yeah.
But the other stuff gave us the iron in our blood and the carbon that makes up life. And, you know, it was important other stuff. But it was mostly hydrogen. That's why the sun is still mostly hydrogen and helium, and most of our bodies are hydrogen, not helium. We probably don't have a single molecule of helium in our bodies, but we are mostly water. So that's and water is mostly hydrogen.
Is that part one, John?
That's part one, and it leads right into part two, and partly explains it. One can assume then that the disk was already formed and forming the sun before it captured all of this debris from the supernovas, correct? Because we have mostly hydrogen in the sun, so there's not a whole lot of the trace elements in there.
Yeah, so I do want to clear up one misconception that will also help answer your question here. When we say that the stars run out of their hydrogen and at the end of their lives, it's not all of the hydrogen that makes up the stars. It's really only the hydrogen in the core of the star. So really only about a third of the hydrogen is gone. So when these stars, you know, end their lives as supernovas, they're still putting back two-thirds of the hydrogen they originally had into the nebulas. Now, we don't know, you know, exactly when our region of space was enriched with all of these other elements, and it's possible that the sun had started to begin to form, but the universe kind of goes continuously through this recycling process where you're always adding new elements and things are always mixing together. So I think it's a combination of just the hydrogen that's always there in the universe plus these nearby stars that must have died and kind of enriched our nebula to make the planets and the star that we have today.
All right.
Very good. Thank you.
John, thanks a lot. All right. A hilarious email came in. The number here, by the way, is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy question for Bob and Valerie. This one came in from Peter in Rosendale. Peter writes, I have nothing but the greatest respect and admiration for Bob Berman. I always listen when he's on. I've read several of his books. I occasionally even try to quote him. But because I have a sense of humor, I'm loving the image of him cringing every time you say Beetlejuice.
And the caller is right. I do cringe. But the reason I've said nothing, even though the two of them are both saying Beetlejuice, is because that's not one of my Don Quixote things. Because, in truth, it's not wrong to say Beetlejuice. It's preferred, supposedly preferred to say Betelgeuse, but it's not wrong. And we're not going to start calling people on things where it's a possible correct spelling.
Okay.
If they said Uranus, well, then I wouldn't be silent.
All right. This is from Doug. Doug writes, isn't the correct pronunciation for that star Betelgeuse? And that's from Doug.
Some people say that, but according to Davis, so what was his first name? And I really liked him because he was an amateur astronomer, George Davis in Buffalo, back in the 1940s. He kept going to the countries where these names came from. That is the Arabic countries, and he had a look up how it used to be pronounced, because as we all know, English used to have an Old English and a Middle English. If you ever had to learn the Canterbury Tales by Chaucer, you know
that.
Yes. And the Arabs, same thing. So to try to figure out how these names, which are two-thirds of the star names are Arabic, and many of them came from the Sumerian before them, he had to learn the Sumerian and learn what the Arabic words were 2,000 years ago. And because he went through the trouble of all of this, I prefer his derivations, and you can still get it, even online for free, a reprint, George Davis, How to Pronounce the Stars, and I think he's the ultimate authority. So when it comes to Betelgeuse, and meantime while we spoke, I grabbed this little reprint, yeah. And Betelgeuse, he says, Betelgeuse, just like that. He said, the evidence is inconclusive as to the first syllable.
Aha.
Several derivations are possible.
All right.
But the name is probably from the Arabic, Ibdaljosa. Literally, you'll like this, the armpit of the white-belted sheep.
Ah, okay. Well, there are any number of jokes that'll get me thrown off the air, so let's just leave it there. This one came in from Sally. Sally says, I heard there's a gold record we shot into space with songs and sounds of the Earth on it. Was that thing tracked, or do we have no idea where it is now? What else is on the record? Were there any plans to send another? Well, I know it's on the record, and that's Helen Reddy's greatest hits, but have we been able to track it?
Yes, we have. So this is on the Voyager spacecraft, right? Launched in the late 1970s.
Yeah,
and the Voyagers have recently left the solar system, but they still ping. They still actually send a little bit of information back to Earth. So we do know where they are, and the hopes is that someday they'll crash land on a planet with aliens who figure out how to build a record player and they can listen to the sounds of Earth.
Right,
unfortunately, the closest they're going to come to another star is in about 50,000 years, and that'll still be a tenth of a light year from a white dwarf star. So they're going to, and by then they'll be long since silent. So anyone trying to detect a school bus-sized object that's not lit up and not giving off any signals, well, good luck. That's a long shot that it'll be found, but who knows? But Valerie's quite right. It's still thanks to the RTGs, and this is why we love plutonium so much, those radioisotope thermoelectric generators that the Voyagers had are still, after all this time, almost half a century, producing enough electricity to send back information from the edge of the solar system.
Bob Berman is here, and Valerie Rapson. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question. And Dave is in Lee, Mass. Dave, you're on.
Good afternoon, everyone. Near where I live, there's a location about the size of a football field where lightning seems to strike repeatedly every year. Could you give me a reason for that? And is that a good place to look for gold?
Oh, Valerie has the answer to that.
Oh, my gosh. I have no idea. I mean, I doubt that there's gold there, but really odd that the lightning keeps hitting there. I don't know. It must have something to do with the metal in the area. Who knows?
Interesting. Is it really high up, Dave?
No. The elevation is probably only like 1,500 feet or something like that. It's metal, but the trees take a beating there, and you can see it in an electrical storm that it comes in at that location for some reason.
Interesting.
Wow.
Well, you've stumped the panel. I guess.
Yeah.
You know what, Dave? If you can hold that thought, the next time we do a science forum, maybe bring that up with some of the other scientists, and maybe they'll have an idea.
Sure. When is that?
Oh, I wish I could tell you what was on next week. I have no idea. But, you know, maybe our geologist would be able to give you some ideas of what's underground and maybe some reasons why. It'll be coming up. It'll be on our website. Unfortunately, I rarely know until the day of the show because, well, I have enough to think about. Hey, Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Derek in Rhinebeck. Derek.
Yes, hold on. Let me put my sandwich away.
Oh, that's great.
Excuse me.
Hi, Derek. Sure, yeah. What kind of sandwich, Derek? What kind of sandwich do you have?
Well, let me tell you. It's turkey.
Oh, yeah.
A nice smoked turkey.
Yeah.
On the rye bread, a little mayo, and lettuce.
That sounds tremendous. That's the call of the show so far.
There we go.
Let me get to my...
Okay.
This is a scientific question.
All right, sir.
My Uncle Morris had a thermos bottle. You know the thermos bottle,
sure.
Right?
Sure, yes.
You put in hot and you put in cold. How does the thermos bottle know?
Well, okay, let's have Valerie give this one a shot. You got an answer for Derek?
Well, I mean, so the material that these bottles are made of are designed to insulate, whether they're insulating cold or insulating hot. You know, they're trying not to transfer heat either in or out.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a reaction between, you know, the temperature of the liquid and then the material that the bottle's made of. I guess that'd be the simplest explanation.
Okay.
I think I can take it one step further. A thermos also has two important components. One is an area that's very highly reflective. It used to be done with silvered glass, but because those would break reliably every time you drop them, it's now made with other material. But it's a very highly reflective, and reflective is just that. It'll also reflect infrared, and therefore it'll keep the heat in, and it'll tend to keep the heat from reaching it from the other side. So also... You need to have a vacuum.
Right.
Now, originally, thermoses had, you can't have a complete vacuum because then the thermos would be like, you know, $100,000. But
right.
If you have a partial vacuum, that prevents heat from traveling, which brings up the difference between infrared, incidentally, and heat. Because infrared will travel perfectly well through the vacuum of space. But what we normally call heat, which is just the movement of atoms, that's what heat is, just atoms moving faster or molecules moving faster. Right. Well, you can't have that if you don't have atoms or molecules. So if you have a place that's relatively a vacuum, a chamber, then the heat can't be transferred from one and can't leak out or leak in.
Derek, does that make sense?
Oh, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. I don't use the thermos for that anymore.
Right.
I use the thermos for small change.
Oh.
I keep changing the thermos.
Yeah, that's good, man. Hey, listen, enjoy the sandwich, my friend. Thank you for calling. Always great to hear from Derek on the program. I don't know how you follow that up. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. If you tell us what you're having for lunch, ask an astronomy question. It's all open game here on the program, and we'll be back. If you missed earlier, Derek is having a turkey sandwich with mayo and lettuce. You might want to write that down for the next program. There may be a test. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. It's astronomy and other things. This email came in from Michael in Cummington. Michael says, I understand that the Earth rotates because during its formation from a cloud of dust to a planet, some force, I'm sure you will name what that force is, caused the body as it is forming to rotate. My question, why doesn't the moon rotate? After all, it was formed from all the dust that was caused when after Earth's collision with a huge meteor. One more question, please. Bob, you mentioned during this program about a year ago how you achieved a profound state of peace. Would you expound on that a little bit? It's a lot to cover. Michael in Cummington.
Well, first of all, the moon does rotate. The moon makes one spin in 27.32166 days, exactly. And the reason some people think it doesn't rotate is because it spins at the same rate at which it goes around us. And by doing that, it's synced up. so that the same features appear in the same spot. So it looks like it's not moving, but it has to move so that the same features appear in the same spot. If it weren't rotating, then as it went around us, we'd see all sides of the moon, wouldn't we? So, and nor is that even odd, because every single moon of every single planet does the same thing. It has a captured or synchronous rotation to match its orbital period around its parent planet. So that's common. And so everything in the known universe spins. Nothing doesn't spin.
Okay. Now, what about this profound piece?
That's really off this topic. You really want me to go there?
Not really. No, Valerie, do you have any peace?
Oh, well, I'm always peaceful, but I don't know about profound peace. Okay. It sounds like Bob has found something really special.
Oh, yeah.
No, I wasn't finding it. I was actually in college when I was studying for, it was about a month that a friend was into Zen.
Yeah.
And so I was reading these books about Zen, and it said that there was a state at which you could actually know the truth of the universe, but to be there, you had to have no thoughts. Your thoughts had to be gone. Your thinking mind had to be gone.
Ah, mission and then accomplished.
You could be supposedly one with the universe in this supposed state. So, of course, I would have wanted to be there, and I tried to stop my mind from thinking, and nothing worked. Of course, nothing worked. But it was a month that I tried to focus and stop thinking and be one, and nothing worked. And then one night when I was studying for a test in my junior year of college, all of a sudden, something in the textbook just triggered this thing where it's really ineffable. Can't be put into words, so I'll spare everyone the details except for a 10-second to say that for the next 3 weeks, there were no thoughts in my mind. It was crystal clear, self-evident, that there's no birth and death. There's no such thing as time, that everything is perfect, that there is a single consciousness, a single life, a single oneness to the universe. Everything was just blissful and ecstatic and clear, and along with that experience was a sense of certainty. It wasn't something new. It was like a recognition of returning to something very familiar and ancient. And so it obviously changed my life.
Wow.
I wish it was still there now. So when Valerie says, attained, you know, what have you attained? No, unfortunately, after 3 weeks, my mind came back in the form of songs playing through my head, Beatles songs and stuff.
Really?
And so eventually I had my logical mind back, and that was the end of everything. But it certainly did affect my life.
Is this Bob Berman or Tex Watson? Who am I talking to here? This is
I would not have brought it up,
promise you. Let's go to Bill in Hudson. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I got two quick questions. I'm hoping one of the guests or both can identify something that I noticed in the night sky starting a few summers ago. And it's directly above head, and it's very very bright, either planet or a star, but it's very blue. And I'm just wondering what that one is.
Well, that would be Vega. Vega would be the bluest star that gets to be straight overhead at this time of year and through the summer.
Yeah, definitely take a look up and see if you can make a triangle with three other bright stars. And if you can, you probably found Vega.
Oh, cool. That's good to know.
Now she's going to say Vega, and this I'm not going to sit still for, because it comes from originally an Arabic word that was pronounced Wega, and until a century ago, my archaic textbooks all spelled it W-E-G-A until about 100 years ago. So it's been corrupted from Wega now to Vega. Unfortunately, with that Jodie Foster movie Contact, where everyone in the film pronounced it Vega, and there was one guy in the audience, okay, it was me, shouting at the screen, no, but okay.
All right, you know, interestingly,
do we know why it's so blue?
Yeah, it's hot and young.
Yeah, it's a much bigger star than our sun, so it's just bluer and hotter.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot. Interestingly, I used to drive a Chevy Wega. It was pretty nice. Nicole in Bristol, Vermont. Nicole, you're on.
Hello there.
Hi.
I think I need to turn the radio off.
Me too.
Or at least turn
it
down.
No, I...
Just a second. I'll do that.
Okay.
There we go. So I'm calling just to share a memory that one of your reports sparked, and that was that I was at Cornell University in the 70s and went to a talk given by Carl Sagan, at which he played the entire recording that was going to go on to Voyager. Yeah.
And
it was really beautiful hearing all of those voices from all around the world.
It was a lovely thing. We don't do things like that anymore. I wish we did.
It was really beautiful, and I couldn't actually tell from the comment, the comment that was made, whether we can still hear that recording. Is it available anywhere? I've never
heard. You can call it up on the internet. Just type it in for Voyager recording, and you'll hear the music. It's Bach and Chuck Berry and all sorts of things. And there were also visuals as well, as there was a New England sunset and a lot of visual images as well, if the aliens can figure out how to extract them from the record.
Right. That's what we're all talking about afterwards. There was a wonderful question and answer section session afterwards, too, and he was just delightful, just, a really special.
Nice. It also generated a lot of paranoia because on the cover, the jacket of the record, there were two nude people, a man and a woman, and there were members of Congress that were very upset about us ascending smut into space. On the record was an indication of where we are located relative to pulsars. In other words, there were the coded pulsar beats. And where, in what direction from a bunch of pulsars you'd find Earth. And a lot of people were upset by this, too, because, hey, why assume that they're all friendly and nice up there? Are you sure you really want to send our location anonymously into space? Shouldn't you just leave well enough alone?
Yeah. Right.
I agree.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, Nicole, thanks a lot.
Another famous person, I'll let you go, that was at Cornell when I was there was Jill Cornell.
Oh,
nice.
Oh, interesting.
You know who she is now, right? She's in charge of, is it SETI? Jill, but she has a married name, and I don't know what her married name is. But she was one of the first women in physics at Cornell when I was there.
Very cool.
So, fantastic.
Well, Nicole, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. We have been all over the map today on the program. From sandwiches to pronunciations. What's next? Gina in Westchester. Gina.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good.
I have two quick questions. Is Sirius the brightest star in the sky, and where can I locate it? And are there any meteor showers coming soon that we can see?
Shall I take the first, and Valerie, you take the second?
Sure, go for it.
Just arbitrarily, I mean, either of us could answer either of those. Sirius, the dog star, yes, brightest star in the sky, minus magnitude 1.6. Nothing is remotely as bright, and you can find it. It's a winter star, so the easiest way to find it is just to follow Orion's belt down and to the left, and it points right towards this star. Same color as Vega, by the way, a blue, distinctly blue star, but you won't miss it because it's the brightest star. And since we're talking bright, before Valerie takes over and answers your second part, I do want to say, because we only have a few minutes left, that even though the supposed eclipse of the moon that will get a lot of media attention on Saturday night, July 4th night, is a partial penumbra. The moon will not change. Nobody's going to see an actual eclipse happening. Nonetheless, the moon can be very special that night if you keep watching it at around 10, 11 o'clock when it starts rising up higher. Look to the left of the moon, and you'll see Jupiter and Saturn together. They're getting closer and closer. They're going to blend into a single bright object on the winter solstice. So this is going to be the best planet conjunction of our lives, and this is a perfect weekend to first get a preview of it. Just to the left of the moon, 11 o'clock would be perfect when it's just rising in the east. Jupiter is the brightest. Saturn is less bright. They're both to the left of the moon this weekend.
All right. It's part two.
And the meteor shower.
Yeah.
Right. You asked about the meteor shower. So the next big one is Perseus. It usually peaks around August 12th. And you want to go out. Usually best time is like 1 or 2 in the morning. But if you're not up for getting up or staying up that late, just go outside before dawn. That's the best time to look for them. And just kind of
look up in the sky, you could see up to 100 meteors an hour. This is usually a pretty big one. And yeah. I haven't seen the exact rate of this year's predicted one come out, but definitely a good sight to see. Nice to be outside in the summertime at night.
Hey, Gina, where are you calling from in Westchester, by the way?
Cortland Manor.
Oh, sure. Beautiful there. Thank you very much for the call. You know, Valerie, quickly, before we get to the next phone call,
yeah.
How accurate are these predictions when they say, well, it's going to be a moderate meteor shower this time?
Yeah, well, they take their best guess, right? I mean, we don't know exactly how much stuff our planet is about to crash into, but, you know, based on what we can observe that's moving into our area, we can kind of make a prediction, but, you know, it's never super exact. We do know which meteor showers will produce generally more meteors to see, but, you know, exactly whether it's 10 or 20 an hour for a specific one is kind of somewhat arbitrary.
Yeah, I mean, a bigger factor is usually how bright the moon is, because the moon is the big spoiler right. when the moonlight's too bright. Fortunately, this year, on the night of August 11th to 12th, the moon will not be full, but it'll be closer to a last quarter moon. That is the final half of the That's night, good. Which, as Valerie pointed out, is normally the best time to see the Perseids. That's when the moon is going to be up. No. So this is one of those rare years that you might just want to start observing before midnight, okay. or before the moon rises. Normally you don't want to do that with the Perseids, but this year maybe make an exception.
All right, roger that. Let's go to Fred in Schoharie. Fred, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much, Valerie, Ray, and Bob. I just had a question about satellites. When I look up about 10:30 at night, and if I look most of the time from, I think it's south to north, very high, much higher than a plane, and it's not flashing, and very, very dim, moving quite quickly. Looks like either the space station or a satellite, and again, most of the time south to yeah. north. And I think once or twice I saw it the other direction, north to south, about 10:30 or 11 at night. Just wondering which ones would be the space station and communication satellites, and which ones are military satellites?
Those are military satellites, the one that you yeah. just described.
Okay, so south yep. north is military. And
yeah, that's a
north,
favorite
south,
orbit
south.
Because that way they have the entire Earth in view, at least every spot of the Earth beneath them at least once a day. So the military loves those north-south satellites. And generally you can see if they're still functioning, too, whether the light is relatively steady or whether it's blinking on and off. When it's blinking, it usually means it's tumbling and reflecting light unevenly, which means it's not really functional anymore. And then the speed that you were describing tells you how high they are. And so there's a lot you can pick up by satellites. Normally, it's a lot of fun to watch satellites, but if you've been listening to us the last few months, you know that we've become less and less amused.
All right, Fred, yeah. thank you very much. All right, let me ask you a question. Now, are either of you fairly well versed on the comings and goings of the Iridium satellite?
Yes, yeah, sure, sure.
How often,
Absolutely.
Now, you know, it'll make that flash. How often in the course of one pass over your head will it make that flash?
Oh, it'll only make one flash for you in the course of a pass. The thing about the Iridium satellites is their solar panels are so big that right below them they reflect the sunlight, and essentially they're casting a spotlight of sunlight,
yes.
a little tiny spotlight, onto the Earth as they're traveling. And so if your house, your backyard, is under that, you're going to see a brilliant, much brilliant, more brilliant than any other satellite, but the flash will only last a few seconds. Hmm. Happily, if you just go online and type in Iridium satellite passage over your house or something like that, you put in your location, either the town or your latitude and longitude, and it'll give you to the second the next passages of Iridium satellites. You go out there with an accurate clock, an atomic clock, or your cell phone clock, and you can count on it. It'll tell you what direction to face, how high up, hmm. and boom, wow, wait till you see that flash.
But only one
yeah,
flash. Go ahead, Valerie.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, we get calls all the time from people that see explosions in space, and they're always curious if it was a supernova, and most of the time it's just one of those Iridium satellites, and they happen to be looking up at just the right time, and they're so spectacular. If you've never seen one, I can totally imagine why you think it'd be a star exploding in the sky if you didn't know better.
You know, my daughter, my oldest daughter and I were out in the back at the fire pit a couple of weeks ago, and we watched the satellites pretty often. And this one would go kind of a normal satellite track, but it would flash periodically. So it flashed a number of times as it went across the sky. And I couldn't find anything that really...
That's an unusual one, Ray. What happened is that you've got a rotating or tumbling satellite that was periodically reflecting one bright section of itself.
Yeah, that must be it.
To you. Yeah, that's the exception to the rule, what you're describing.
All right, this is an email here, and we'll do this one, and maybe you can both take a shot. We'll go Valerie first. Kyle wants to know, do you have any book recommendations for people looking to read more about astronomy and the cosmos?
Well, there are so many great books. All you got to do is go to the library and, you know, walk down the astronomy section and pick any of them up. I mean, I love Neil deGrasse Tyson's books. You know, he writes very well, and, you know, he has a good tone. He explains things, but, you know, everybody can understand him. So really, any of his books, and, you know, Bob has written many books, so I'm sure he will have a lot of great recommendations. So that's what I would go for.
So, Bob, you should be recommending your own books now.
Go. Yeah, I was waiting for Valerie to say that. I was like, what am I, chopped liver here? I have 12 books out.
No, I didn't mean that.
I know. I'm just kidding. I'm just teasing you. Yeah, so I'd say Zoom. The one that got me on the Letterman show was my first, Secrets of the Night Sky. That's about naked eye astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
That's still available. That was from HarperCollins. Zoom is a book I like, and Ray previously mentioned The Sun's Heartbeat, if you're interested in this, in the sun.
That's a great book.
And I'd say out of the 12 books, I'd say one of those three might be a nice place to start.
All right, and then finally here, as we wrap up the program, an email from Aaron in Greenfield, Massachusetts. My new guru, Lama Bob Berman. There you go.
I was afraid of that. You made me do it, Ray.
Hey, man, I'm just the host. And, you know, now it's time for a turkey sandwich with lettuce and mayo. Hey, thank you both for being here. We'll see you next time.
Yes.
Support comes from Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, accepting new clients, careersintransitionllc.com. Once again, thanks to Valerie Rapson of the Dudley Observatory and Bob Berman for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the calls and the sandwich orders. Thank you to Zach Malloy, our engineer. And Jordan Yuxall took the calls today. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. It's the holiday weekend. I want you to do a couple things for me. I want you to have fun. I want you to be safe. I want you to not drink and drive. Those three things, okay? And then we'll see you on Monday after the 4th of July holiday for a medical Monday at 2 p.m. And we'll have the latest on the coronavirus. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.